Welcome to another edition of National Bugle Radio. I'm your host, Patrick Slattery. Today, we have Professor Andrew Joyce joining us from Great Britain, and he's here to talk about Hillary's alt-right speech and Brexit and whatever other topics we get to. So thank you very much for coming on, Dr. Joyce.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Well, and we've gotten very good responses from, you know, the last couple of times you've been on the show. And we've also been banned. Our last program, or maybe the one before that, was banned on YouTube's Germany and certain offshore American island outlets. I don't exactly know how that process works, but it means somebody's listening to us and somebody's thinking. Not necessarily...
It means we're annoying the right people, I like to think.
Yeah, we're annoying the right people. Okay. Well, just a few days ago, Hillary Clinton had this big speech on the alt-right. And I have to admit, I guess the term the alt-right might have been around for a few years. I have heard that Richard Spencer coined the term. I'm really not sure of its origin. But, you know, I've only been hearing about it for the past year or so. And I guess it's still in its infancy, the term at least, not necessarily the movement it represents. But the term itself is young enough that it's still a little bit up for grabs, and various people would define it in various ways. And it seems that, you know, the Washington Post and much of the established media, the Jewish-owned established media, they're trying to define it in a way that suits their own interests. And, I want you to comment on it. They're also trying to frame, the movement and define the movement and name its leaders. And this is something that I thought had happened very much to the detriment of the Tea Party about 8 years ago when it had risen around the Ron Paul campaign, Ron Paul for President campaign in 2007, 2008. I think on the day after Obama's inauguration in January 2009, Fox News did a big story on the Tea Party and basically redefined it, took away a lot of its aspects and turned it into something more to their own liking with their own leadership. And, you know, I see Milo, what's his last name, Yiannopoulos, his name being bantered around as the leader of the alt-right, which seems a little bit bizarre that a self-proclaimed half-Jewish gay man would be the leader of this type of movement. But having said all that, how do you define the alt-right? What does it mean? And then your response to Hillary's speech on it. And you can take that in any order you'd like.
Yeah. I think first and foremost, it's pretty clear that alt-right means many different things to many different people. You've got the gamer kind of sect, and for them it's a reaction against, you know, the encroachment of females into the gaming industry. I think that they claim that's how they got involved with the alt-right through the whole Gamergate issue. But despite these kind of peripheral orbiting issues, for me the alt-right boils down to, in essence, an anti-Jewish movement. I think that's what's at the core of pretty much all aspects of the alt-right's ideological arsenal. I think that when you look at Hillary's speech and she's sort of attacking what she sees as the misogyny of the alt-right or the racism of the alt-right, when you sort of pull back the curtain of each of those issues, what you really find is there's a lot of anger and frustration with Jewish involvement in tampering with relations between the sexes through the Jewish involvement in the feminist movement, with the tampering in relations between the races, when you look at Bayesian anthropology, right the way through to the work of Gould, in this book, The Mismeasure of Man,
Stephen
with
Gould.
How the races... Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. with how the races interact with each other. And it's, for me, the alt-right is a ferocious and increasingly well-organized reaction against this Jewish intrusion into Western society, particularly in the United States. And there will always be people who are more or less attached to the Jewish question within that movement, but really all of the grievances that they may have that have mobilized them into action can all be traced to that one core. All of this discussion about the alt-right as a term, how it can be defined, who is a member of the alt-right movement and who isn't, reminds me very much of another term that was brand new in the late 19th century, and that term was anti-Semitism, coined, of course, by the journalist Wilhelm Marr. Now, at the time, Jews were very heavily involved in trying to intervene in the communication, if you want to put it like that, between those who described themselves as part of the political anti-Semitic movement and the public at large. And now, the self-styled political anti-Semites at the time would have said, look, we want to be open and honest about Jewish influence in our society. We want certain issues which have been taboo up until now to be capable of public discussion. We want to address this in an intellectual manner with a press that does it, that performs its duty rather than skewing the facts. And within that movement, you had people like Heinrich von Treitschke, a very famous historian and very much well-respected, and many others at the time who occupied significant and honored positions in society. So we're not looking at a bunch of rough and ready types here. We're looking at a very intellectual elite within German society in particular at that time that rose to the fore, that formed this umbrella term, and many, many people were brought in under its wings. Jews, on the other hand, were very keen to translate this movement in very different terms to the public. So rather than being intellectual and wanting to provoke and stimulate the appropriate level of political discussion, the press, and again, this is predominantly a Jewish-dominated press, wanted to translate that term and that movement as something much more vulgar, much more trashy, so that they tainted it in various ways. They presented it as being just racist and, their version of what the term racist meant, and vulgar and violent and deeply insidious. And most importantly of all, as we look at how Hillary is presented, the alt-right, is they were very, very keen to present the intellectual and political anti-Semitic movement as this un-German. That's the phrase they used. It was un-German. And you will see that there is a very strong push now to present the alt-right, which, from my perspective, and I'm sure from yours also, and many other people, the alt-right is has developed organically as a reaction of the American people. It is as American as it gets, but it will be portrayed and has now been portrayed and will increasingly be portrayed as very, very much un-American. So it will be framed in terms of, oh, it's opposed to the democratic process, it's anti-woman, it's anti-diversity, because of course diversity has now been incorporated very recently in the last 60 years as being a key part of the American identity.
And spawned by Vladimir Putin, the great Satan.
Yeah, of course. That's another, you've hit the nail on the head there, Patrick, because that's another thing that is a tried and tested Jewish tactic, is to try and link the indigenous reaction to some kind of suspected or highly suspect foreign tyrant. In the past, when there were conflicts between Germany and France in the 19th century, it was a common tactic to try and portray German anti-Semitism as somehow being tainted with the French. It was a French intrusion into German society, and vice versa. The French reaction against Jews was described as being, that was an import. And in it was the same in Britain, actually, during the Second World War, when you had Mosley's movement, Jews in Britain at that time, the Board of Deputies of British Jews based in London were very, very keen in their counter-propaganda to portray Mosley and his movement and lots of genuine antagonism towards what was increasingly described as the Jewish War as, oh, that's German propaganda. Real British people don't think like this. And you'll hear it wherever you go. Jews will say in the United States, this is un-American. In France, they'll say it's un-French. In Germany, they'll say it's un-German. When really, you know, that's quite ridiculous, because they are actually the most un-American, un-French, and un-German element within those various societies,
mm-hmm.
both with the proposals that they're introducing, basically flooding those nations with you know, the dictionary definition of un-Germans and un-French, and by virtue of the fact that they are foreigners,
right
the way through to their genuine and quite evident antagonism to the indigenous people of those nations.
That's right. I mean, I would say that under this, what you could call the diversity regime, the recent immigrant is more celebrated, more American than the person whose ancestors came here several generations ago and founded the country. Or in the case of Europe, you know, even I don't have the direct experience in Europe, but in the case of Europe, the people whose ancestors have been there for thousands of years.
Of course. It's a very, very strange and a very contorted situation and reality that we now live in. And, you know, there was a case in Britain, I think it's going back to when, I think even before Gordon Brown became Prime Minister, it was during a Labour election. And Gordon Brown was, I think, still Chancellor of the Exchequer at that time, and they were out canvassing for votes for the Labour Party. And there was an elderly lady, while he was out there, you know, shaking hands with people and things like that, who came up to him, and she said, you know, Gordon, what are you going to do about immigration? You know, my town isn't what it was before. And I think he ignored her, but when he got back into the car that was going to transport him quickly away from the great unwashed, as he might have seen them, his microphone was still on, and journalists happened to pick up on the fact that he muttered under his breath as he got into the car, "What a nasty bigot!"
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was later forced to make an apology, but this lady wasn't a nasty bigot. She was concerned about the fact that her entire way of life was changing so radically,
mm-hmm.
and she would have been viewed, I am certain, by Gordon Brown as being un-British,
mm-hmm.
as being against British values.
Right.
But this is a woman who is being described as un-British or against British values based on comments she made because of her own organic link going back centuries, if not millennia, in that land. It's bizarre, and it's quite sick.
Well, you know, in the United States, in Washington, D.C., there's a publication called The Hill. It's a political magazine. And on their website, they recently had a piece written by a couple of black authors, and it was attacking David Duke, who's running for Senate in Louisiana. It made really some nonsensical complaints about his view of race, which, you know, he views it as being biological, and they insist that it is a socio-political construct. Well, that issue aside, at the end of their article, they said that people like David Duke have no place in this country, and invited David Duke and those like him to leave the country. So not only are people who are concerned about the transformation of society from the one that they were born in to the one that is now being dominated by, you know, in certain ways, numerically maybe dominated by immigrants and families of recent immigrants, but politically dominated by this tiny Jewish elite. Anybody who complains about it, not only are they called un-American, but are being told there's no place for them here. Now, there's a place for people from every other corner of the globe, but there's no place for Americans whose ancestors actually built the country and whose brethren currently supply most of the labor and most of the tax money to support this, the transformation of the country into something that it never has been.
Exactly. And at the root of all of that, it's the fact that Jews have been at the forefront of attacking our sense of national identity. It's what, you know, if one wants to make the argument that Jewish intellectualism is essentially a corrosive agent against a nation, then the first thing to come under that corrosive influence is the sense of national identity. And it is attacked on many, many fronts. One of the foremost, actually, is it trickles down out of academia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things that the Jews tended to cluster around very, very quickly. I would say, probably going back to the late 19th century, in a number of European faculties, really reaching its height with the Frankfurt School, but I think it's still as strong today and perhaps getting stronger and stronger. But I would say about 6 months to a year ago, I decided just to sit down at my computer one evening and Google the term, you know, national identity as a construct. And I started off in England, but I branched out. And I found that there were quite a few university and college courses being taught with now with titles like, you know, the making of Englishness. And you can Google that. It is a course.
Englishness, okay.
Yes, exactly.
Which corresponds with the term whiteness, which has become popular on college campuses in recent years. And I think you wrote a lot about whiteness, didn't you?
I did. I wrote an article on this idea of whiteness studies as basically, you know, if you look at black studies, it's not blackness studies or, you know, Asian studies or whatever. They all champion those particular races and emphasize or deeply, in some cases, wildly exaggerate the accomplishments of those races. But whiteness studies exist purely to deconstruct and attack any sense of white identity, to denigrate white achievement, and to encourage, I would argue, incredible hostility against white people. Now, to come back to this point of attacking national identity, these courses of, you know, the construction of Englishness, they tend to be taught overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, by Jews. I don't have any names right now to hand, but perhaps this will be an article I write for the Occidental Observer in the very near future. And it may take the form more or less of a kind of database or a list rather than an article. But this genre of academia, if you want to give it that term, it attracts Jews like a moth to a flame. They are very much, and it's one of the markers, it's one of the indications that the Jews are uniquely hostile towards our identity and our way of life. For all of its apologists, you say, oh, Jews are just like anyone else. You know, they're very much disproportionately found in those areas of our academic and cultural life which exist to bring us down. Mm-hmm. And national identity was one of those ways that we have been attacked. And it really does filter through because, you know, generation after generation of college students then go out into the world, they have children, they marry, they go on, they work in the media, and in many, many cases, they do the Jews' dirty work for them. In one of my past articles, I wrote on Spinoza, I highlighted the fact that, yes, there were lots of these Jewish guru figures at the very top of the pyramid, but as you move down, there were lots and lots of indoctrinated, awe-inspired, willing Gentile helpers who were busily working away, chipping away at their own civilization, and their own nation. So it trickles down from there, and it's difficult to come up with any kind of coherent strategy for dealing with it other than, you know, on the most radical end of the spectrum, you know, excluding or somehow managing Jewish influence in academia. It's something that I've hinted at before in my articles. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's one of the core areas where we have a significant problem with Jewish influence in our society. But it's by those means and those methods that we find ourselves in a situation where if you speak up patriotically and out of loyalty to your nation, out of concern with its downward trajectory, you will be described as the opposite of what you actually are. You will be against Britain if you speak up for Britain. You will be anti-American if you speak up for Americans. Because the battle lines have been completely redrawn. We're playing a game with an opponent that doesn't play by any kind of rules. The rule book is constantly changing.
And the goalposts are constantly being moved. I think that's a really important point.
Of course, the goalposts are constantly being moved. And I think that one of our handicaps as a people is that you look at Northern Europeans or Northwest Europeans, we have this heightened fairness instinct. Kevin McDonald has written about it extensively, and it bleeds into this idea of altruism or pathological altruism, where each day we set off on our lives expecting to have others do to us as we do to them. But in this game, in which it's win or lose, you know, it's the most. We're playing a very high-stakes game here. It's the future of our children and the future of our civilization. The the rules don't exist. They are incredibly fluid. And no matter what we do, we will always find ourselves on the outside of how the rules have been drawn. Right now, yes, David Duke is going to be portrayed as anti-American. He's going to be portrayed as an enemy of the people. He's going to be portrayed as a misanthrope and a hater. Whereas, in fact, if anyone was to take the time to look at his work, they would see that, you know, he really is speaking up on behalf of all races. He's advocating a way of modeling our society and managing interrelationships within that society in a way that would be conducive to a greater societal harmony. Anyone who looks with a cold eye on American society today, or any society across Western Europe, will see that we are far from living in harmony. We live in increasingly suspicious societies. Our neighborhoods are rife with suspicion of each other as they become more diverse. Crime is on the increase. Violent crime is going through the roof. Sexual assault is off the scale. And the battle lines have been drawn. Those ethnic minorities who have come in to our societies are very, very aware of race. They're very aware of the differences between the races, and they see themselves very much as members of a race because they are permitted by the academic cultural environment to pursue that worldview. Blacks are encouraged to see themselves as blacks, and not only that, they're encouraged to see themselves as victimized blacks, victimized by whites. Whites, you know, in playing this game, are blindfolded. Mm-hmm. They're told not to see the color of anyone else. They're also told not to see the color of themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of a handicap, in terms of, you know, reducing this down to simple biology, simple evolution, and simple human existence, it's like having all of your senses numbed. There is no way you can compete in the existence for life if you cannot perceive any of these very important facets, if you cannot see the value of fighting for your own racial group, your own genetic interests, and your own the future of your own children.
Yeah. When I was in graduate school 25 years ago, I took a course on nationalism. We had a Jewish professor who assigned readings mostly by other Jews. And there was talk about the development of nationalism, and it's hard to avoid ethnic definitions, but, you know, when they got to the United States, it was popular to try to portray American nationalism as being based on this proposition nation. Now, 25 years ago, that proposition was the principles that were encoded in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. But I would say that now the proposition around this new American nation is grievance against whites. A group's position within this new American nation is based on the level of their grievance against whites. So blacks have this claim based on slavery and oppression, and Jews have, of course, they have the ultimate claim, which is this Holocaust, which, you know, forget the fact that it's not even alleged to have occurred in the United States, but that puts them head and shoulders above everyone else. And even recent immigrants are indoctrinated to have grievances against Americans for perhaps having to work for a generation or half a generation before they get on the welfare rolls, whatever it might be. And so many whites are just being overwhelmed with this and are going along with it. But, you know, you're calling the alt-right a reaction. Andrew Anglin also calls it a reactionary movement because it's in reaction to this situation. And a little bit of it's starting to get through. I was watching CNN a night or two ago. They were covering the Hillary speech, and they had a focus group. And their focus groups are always overrepresented by minorities, by blacks, homosexuals, or Muslims, you know, who are still a very small portion of the American population. But among their two or three token whites, they had a woman who, in speaking of Obama, just said, he seems to have such disdain for the people whose ancestors actually built the country. And it's very rare that you even get that much of the, you know, the white natural response to this situation being aired without, you know, manipulation or filtering. So it's regular people do seem to start to be getting it. The Trump phenomenon, along with the alt-right phenomenon, I think, are evidence of that.
Yeah, I think it's always been on the tip of the tongue of many people in our movement, that it had to get worse before it would get better. But what was meant by that is that whites were really going to have to feel that the screws were tightening on them before they were pushed to a reaction of the type that you're describing is beginning.
Well, I want to ask you, I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought, but I'm sure you've been keeping track of this whole Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, I have.
And are you familiar with the work of Colin Flaherty, who has a YouTube channel, which is, I guess, subtitled Don't Make the Black Kids Angry? And
Yes.
Okay, so for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, he documents or he uploads videos that were either taken by blacks with their own cell phones of, you know, their friends beating up whites and them laughing at it, or local news segments, things like that. But video documentation of this massive racist violence against whites. And so that seems to be on the rise at the same time this false narrative of black victimhood is just getting stronger and stronger, to the point where now in today's news cycle you have a famous NFL quarterback who's refusing to stand up during the playing of the national anthem because he doesn't want to honor a flag that represents a country that oppresses blacks. So,
yeah.
So my question is, to the extent people are more and more waking up, do you think this Black Lives Matter is playing a large role in it? And what else do you think is playing a very large role? And do you think people are actually waking up to Jewish power, or is that something that's going to take time because it's the biggest taboo? Is that going to take time for people to wake up to it?
First thing I would say is, yes, I do think that Black Lives Matter is going to wake up a lot of white people. I think it already has woken up quite a few already. During my last appearance on the David Duke Show, I sort of gave a summary of some statistics that I'd been studying. I found a website online that claimed to document all of these black people who had been innocent and then shot and murdered or killed in custody in numerous ways by white police officers. And when I probed the actual bios of each of these individuals, you whittled it right down until I think the number eventually was about three people were killed in questionable circumstances out of the I think 360 something that were claimed. Mm. What we're dealing with, you know, with the Black Lives Matter is a completely inorganic and engineered campaign that is, you know, fueled by the academic cultural context that we discussed earlier, and it's, you know, African Americans are definitely in the process of being weaponized against whites. I think I can use that term. Mm-hmm. Because it's gotten that bad. You know, the violence that you described in those videos that have been uploaded, it's on such a scale now. It's on such a level, and it's so extensive, and it's being so carefully manipulated by the media that you have to see it as the weaponization of that community.
Well, if the 9/11 airplanes were weaponized, you know, this black violence against whites has taken a lot more lives than the 9/11 airplanes did. So weaponization, I think, is a very apt term.
Precisely. Now, there's still a disconnect there. Will the mass assault of whites necessarily wake up the bulk of the white population? I don't think so, because firstly, whites need to hear about it, and secondly, they need to have a truthful interpretation of that violence presented to them. That's where the media comes in. The media is still in hostile hands for the most part. So whites will never get a full and accurate picture of the violence being enacted against them. Secondly, if there a particularly horrible case of black-on-white violence occurs, I think there was a case somewhere in the South some time ago, I think one of the white victims' name was Chisholm. It was a young white couple, and the girl was raped and murdered in the most brutal and horrific manner, and her boyfriend was assaulted in the most horrific fashion and executed also. And I remember reading it at the time, this is maybe about 6 or 7 years ago actually, and being stunned into silence and inaction and almost depression for the day because of the details of the brutality of this violence. It was shocking in the extreme. But the thing is, that was never presented to the public. It was never presented to locals in that area as yet another example of this horrific brutality enacted against whites. And I'm sure a statistic analysis could be done on this, but it seems to me that when one finds examples of black-on-white violence that is racially motivated, and in this instance, it was fairly clear-cut that it was, we're not just talking about someone gets shot. We're talking about extremely sadistic and perverted levels of torture, abuse, violence, and agonizing death. I mean, horrible animalistic violence. And I think many similar cases have been reported in South Africa also. But the white public at large is never given the full picture. It's always given it in little pieces. And it's always given it, oh, this was a robbery gone wrong, regardless of the fact that one of the perpetrators was heard to say something like, let's kill this cracker bitch or whatever it might have been. All of the racialized elements, all of the potentially incendiary elements of these cases are extracted before they are passed on to the public. Whereas, if the shoe was on the other foot, if it was white on black violence, which is extremely rare if you look at the statistics, even the slightest hint, or even if it's non-existent, it will some look at the Trayvon Martin case. You had this Hispanic guy, you know, who is metamorphosized into a white racist because
white supremacist.
Yeah, white supremacist. So I very much doubt that in and of itself Black Lives Matter will wake people up. It will be there will need to be great changes in the media for that to happen, for that to be allowed to happen. The alt-right at the minute is growing, and one of the things that it has going for it, it has a very good and growing selection of its own media outlets, but it's the question of how do we get these outlets increasingly to reach that great bulk of the white population. That's I'm sure you think about that too. How do you get more white people to listen to your show? I'm sure David Duke is thinking the same. I'm thinking that Andrew Anglin is pondering the same question. The guys at The Right Stuff, Kevin McDonald, I could go on. It's the big question that we face, but if we can reach some kind of tipping point where the alt-right is so much discussed on CNN or Fox News or whatever it might be, that more and more white people Google the term, then find our media outlets and listen to what we have to say, then the floodgates might open and we might reach a tipping point where we wake everyone up. Well, it's going to be difficult.
Now, the second part of my question was on people waking up to the Jewish role in all of this. And even a lot of the people who are being defined as being part of the alt-right or even leaders of the alt-right. For instance, I mentioned Colin Flaherty. His work is so valuable in terms of don't make the black kids angry. At the same time, he completely denies any Jewish domination of the media, completely. And then you've got Stephen Molyneux, who's got a very widely watched YouTube channel, and he discusses a lot of issues. He'll discuss the race issues, but as soon as the issue of Jewish domination of various fields of endeavor is raised, he says, well, they have an IQ 30 points higher than whites, so what do you expect? And he has at various times claimed to be half Jewish and denied being half Jewish. And, you know, some of the other people who are talked about as being the core of the alt-right or the intellectual godfathers of the alt-right, like, you know, Jared Taylor, they'll studiously avoid talking about the Jewish question. Whereas Andrew Anglin, for instance, he says this is the core of the alt-right. So is the alt-right at its very core, is this anti-Jewish power? Is that how you interpret what you might call the organic alt-right as opposed to the redefined alt-right, the Zionist press's efforts to redefine the alt-right?
I think that, you know, obviously I said earlier that there are, you know, a reasonably diverse number of kind of people who are in the alt-right, you know, the Gamergate type people. You have people who are concerned with black violence, and not everyone is going to be savvy with the Jewish question. However, I think that the alt-right as a movement and as an ideological position is inescapably bound up with the Jewish question, because almost, as I said earlier, almost every grievance that these people may have, and they might not see it themselves, but whether it's black violence, unrestrained immigration, the attack on the family, gay marriage, whatever it might be, if those subjects are looked at in anything other than a completely superficial level, then the Jewish question will present itself. Now, I still don't describe myself as alt-right. I don't see the need to mm-hmm. give myself that label. Mm-hmm. I view myself as part of a much longer, much older European intellectual tradition, in that I am concerned first and foremost with the Jewish question. It was my concern with the Jewish question actually that came first, and then I started to branch out and see its influence in the field of relationships between the sexes and the races and the influence in modern politics and things like that. But I became first and foremost intrigued with the Jewish questions. That was the starting point.
Which is my case as well.
Yeah. And perhaps I'm a little bit biased in how I interpret the alt-right for that reason. But as I see it, there isn't much that differentiates the alt-right from nationalist movements of that were present, for example, in Britain in the 1960s, in Central Europe in the 1930s, in Eastern Europe in the 1920s, or, you know, I could go back to, you know, the United States and various white nations going back right into the 19th century. I think there was a much longer intellectual tradition going on here. It's perhaps remodeled, repackaged for the internet age, and that's important. And I think that the Twitter generation and the capability of our younger generations in particular to become savvy with this technology and use it to push what is essentially an old message in new forms is very valuable. But to come back to this issue of people like Jared Taylor and Stephen Molyneux and others, I think in some cases there is a resistance to address the Jewish question out of fear. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the great successful Jewish strategies for combating anti-Semitism is to taint it as somehow a dirty word, or a intellectually tainted, or not laughable, but sort of tinfoil hat-ish kind of subject, perhaps prone to obsessiveness. So people are reluctant to move in a direction that might see them change in their image or their self-image. So there might be suspicion on a personal level among these people of moving too close into that subject. Mm. I still think there's a curiosity about there. I think that there is a certain level of disingenuousness among some of these individuals who are so studiously avoid addressing the Jewish question. I think that so many of the facts that we're dealing with in terms of the Jewish question are completely inescapable and cannot help but thrust themselves upon even the most blinkered, old-school conservative who is concerned about black IQ, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but I would be very surprised if you know, the likes of Jared Taylor and others hadn't at some point in their lives picked up a textbook or read the work of Kevin MacDonald and tried to grapple with their own opinions on the subject, at least. Mm-hmm. So I think that in many cases the lady doth protest too much, and we shouldn't read too much into those among us in the alt-right who profess innocence when it comes to anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I think that I would have maybe more respect for some of these figures if they were more honest about their position on it. But look, everyone is trying to strategize and come up with that one golden ticket that will take us to the awakening of that bulk of the white nation. So I'm not going to be too hard on those who feign innocence. Mm-hmm. But for me, the alt-right is inescapably and irrefutably bound up with the Jewish question and with an attempt to address it. Yes, in several forms, but address it nonetheless. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, regarding the way people respond to the Jewish question or avoid responding to it, you know, it gets back to this issue of how do you define your movement, you know, even if you're going to call it alt-right or something else, how is it defined? Who's in, who's out? Who is pushing it forward? Who is blocking its progress? I mean, those are real questions, and I don't want to sow a lot of seeds of discord within people who need to be working together. So, for instance, somebody like Colin Flaherty does such valuable work. If he wants to avoid the Jewish question, and by avoiding the Jewish question is able to reach a much broader audience, with his valuable work, then certainly that's something I'm happy to look the other way and not criticize him for that. You know, and then you have other people who, perhaps somebody like Alex Jones, if you look at him over his career, where he's basically looking at the damage that's done by Jews and then ascribing it to some hidden Nazi secret government. And then you wonder, well, he's drawing attention to real problems, but then ascribing them to imaginary perpetrators. So, you know, at some point, it does become a real question. And then, of course, you have others who deal with it in different ways. I know people who will speak out fairly forthrightly about the Jewish issue, but then in order to protect themselves, claim to be Jewish when they're not necessarily even Jewish. Just make this claim. And, you know, then there's the question of, well, do you have to be Jewish? If you're not Jewish, do you not have a right to talk about Jewish power? I mean, Jews talk about it all the time amongst themselves and sometimes in front of others. So it gets to those questions. Okay, while we still have some time, I want to ask you a little bit about Brexit, which was, the Brexit vote was welcomed with great fanfare. It was a revolutionary event that was going to change the history of Europe. Do you still look at it that way, or did you ever look at it that way?
No, I never looked at it that way. In fact, for some time, I was quite antagonistic towards the whole Brexit movement. And the reason why I was antagonistic towards the Brexit movement is it was such a single issue bit of politics that it distracted from really what people were voting for. Now, the British people, yes, they were voting to leave the EU, but why were they voting to leave the EU? They wanted to leave the EU because they wanted to gain control over their borders. They wanted to make a last-ditch attempt to salvage what Britain was. And when you look at the voter demographics, if you look at the average age of those who voted to leave the EU, it was predominantly, overwhelmingly in fact, the older generation. This is the generation who witnessed their country in the space of about 50 years go from being 98% white to being, you know, having that figure radically reduced, to the point where London is majority non-white, Birmingham is heading in the same direction, and some of the smaller cities like Leicester are gone perhaps forever. They have witnessed in their midst the rape of thousands, tens of thousands of their children by Pakistani and Indian subcontinent Muslims. They have witnessed black crime on an unimaginable scale, and they have witnessed the utter degradation and decay of their culture. And they are, in many respects, heartbroken about it. And they don't understand quite how it happened, because it happened so very fast. And they have been, on so many occasions, muzzled in how they could respond to it because of the advent of political correctness, the attack on free speech in Britain, which is in one of our previous conversations, Patrick. It's well documented that this was due to Jewish influence, and they are at a loss. And this was a last ditch. They were told that Brexit, if they voted for it, would be the panacea to their ills. It would give them back control. It would do this. It would do that. It would do so much for them. But in the end, it was just a mirage. You know, Brexit has been achieved. Eventually, Britain will leave the EU. But do I believe for a second that the numbers of immigrants from even outside the EU, because that's what people are most concerned about, will those decrease? No, it won't. Because the chain marriage system in which young Indians and Pakistanis are sent back to the Indian subcontinent to pick a spouse and then bring that person back with them, mm-hmm. The law which allows that to happen will remain in place. The asylum system will remain in place, and so many of the systems permitting the influx of non-Europeans into Britain at an astonishing pace will continue. And all of those British people who voted for Brexit will receive nothing out of it but a stab in the back. That is what is coming to Britain, a stab in the back.
Okay, I have one question. So the very fact that the vote succeeded where it wasn't expected to succeed, is there any significance in that in terms of just teaching people that they still have the numbers to prevail? Does that lesson itself have any value?
Well, yeah, but it's as far as lessons go, it's rather weak because in one of my articles on Brexit, I think it was I wrote an article on Jews and Brexit. I drew attention to the fact that generationally speaking and demographically speaking, this was the last roll of the dice.
Mm-hmm.
The generation that still retains memories of a pre-political correctness era and would be willing to go out on a limb and vote along those lines, it won't be here in another 20 years, Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
It's that generation's, you know, it's on its way out, and the coming generation is either going to be mixed race, non-white, or the white element that is there will be so heavily indoctrinated through the education and cultural system that it will vote itself out of existence. So, you know, this is what we're looking at here is a sand timer that is rapidly running out of grains. There isn't much left in the timer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why if there was going to be a huge push, I would have much preferred a effective nationalist movement to focus on immigration and immigration alone. A Britain that stays in the EU, where the EU has control over its borders and doesn't permit the mass influx of non-whites, that's an EU that might be worth thinking about staying in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we get bogged down in constitutional issues, you have it in the United States as well. Oh, the Constitution is sacrosanct. When the Constitution and the legal system and the system of government itself is corrupt and part of the problem, then you need to stop worrying about constitutions and sovereignty and all these peripheral issues. I need to get back to an almost prehistoric level of concern, which is what's good for my kids,
mm-hmm.
what's good for my neighbor, what's good for my village, what's good for my town, and what's good for my ethnic group. These are the concerns that should be motivating people, and these concerns alone to get the British public so distracted on such highfalutin issues as international sovereignty is nothing more than a puppet show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Brexit was. And right now, the wind has been taken out of the sails more than ever of British nationalism. It is
taken
dead
out
in the water.
The wind's been taken out of the sails of British nationalism. So are you saying that there's nobody who has positioned themselves to pick up where Brexit left off, provide political leadership, and transfer the spotlight to immigration? There's nobody in UKIP or anywhere else who is willing or able to do this?
No, there is no one. Nigel Farage showed his colors in terms of his loyalty to the British people as opposed to loyalty to a single issue bit of politics when he resigned pretty much as soon as Brexit was accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as that one achievement had been notched up, he walked. He didn't say, look, we've achieved this, now I want to see it through. I want to see the government rein in immigration. I want to see the aspirations of my voters who voted for my issue. He abandoned it completely. He was just a single-issue politician. And from my perspective, Nigel Farage is a traitor to the British people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that anyone in our movement who looks at it objectively and coldly and in terms of the issues that matter would agree with me 100%. Now, is there anyone else on the scene? No, because British nationalism is in complete disarray. The British National Party died 5 or more years ago. It ate itself alive. Again, it made a big deal out of getting seats in the European Parliament, and it did. You know, it was almost a victim of its own success. It's like a dog that chases a bone for so long, and when it gets it, it doesn't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, that's a curse that we have. Now, it might be the same with Donald Trump. If there's a warning here, if Americans, those in the alt-right movement, or whatever label you want to give it, if they pursue the single goal of getting Trump into office to the exclusion of serious ideological concerns and non-negotiables, then they will reach the same anti-climax.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be catastrophic. So Trumpism must be ferociously clung to rather than Trump. And a focus on Trumpism will help the movement survive whether he succeeds or fails.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big mistakes in Britain is that everyone chased Brexit rather than really throwing the spotlight on the feeling of the people which underlay the push for Brexit.
So we're getting close to the end of the hour, but I guess one last question. You're talking about Donald Trump, and did you hear over the past week or so he was gearing up for a big address on immigration policy, and he had an interview on Fox News with Sean Hannity and seemed to be backtracking substantially, and then the next day or two did damage control and went back to what had been his position a year ago, which was much more hard line against immigration. Did you follow that at all, and do you have any thoughts on that?
I did, and my opinion on it is this. Trump is a politician, and like any bourgeois politician, he will negotiate. He says he self-describes as a negotiator. He confronts a mammoth task in terms of trying to deal with the inertia of the American political system and the huge opposition he will face in Congress, no matter what the outcome of the presidential election. By all means, I encourage people to vote for Trump, but I would counsel against exaggerated expectations that he will be able to deliver on immigration. I think before we reach a point where the goals of our movement in terms of immigration, race, ethnicity, and the Jewish question will be achieved, massive cultural change will be required. The alt-right at the minute is predominantly a cultural rather than political movement, and I think that that is for the best. Yes, it can throw its cultural weight behind political candidates and political causes, but the culture must change, and control over the attention, if you want to use that analogy, we must get the attention of the bulk of the white population. Then we can really accomplish something, because that white attention needs to be focused, not just in the longer term, not just on political candidates and political parties, but it must be focused on issues. White people must be told that they should not be satisfied until they reclaim sovereignty in their own land and their own territory. That it is a non-negotiable. The battle for them should not be seen as ending with the election of some politician or other being to office. That's not where it ends. The British public, the American public, the public throughout Europe, the white public needs to stand up and say, look, these are our interests, these are our goals, this is what we want to achieve, this is our voice. We aren't delegating any longer to politicians who are going to stab us on the back or who will be compromised in some form or other by vested interests, and in most cases we know exactly who those vested interests are. The voice of the people must be heard. They must realize that they need to speak more directly in the lives of their nations. I mean, that's, from my perspective, one of the ways in which democracy, parliamentary democracy, kills a nation, is because we grow comfortable with the fact that we delegate our say in our lives to elected officials, you know? I've never voted in my life, not once. Wow. And the reason why is because I don't trust anyone who puts themselves up for election as worthy of my vote or who will speak for my interests or voice my worldview. I can't vote. It would be pointless. I would be endorsing a system or a candidate who is anathema to my interests and those of my children, those of my family, my town, and my people. So,
well, you can always vote for yourself. Trump, at least in most places in America, you can write in and you can vote for yourself if you want. I do encourage people to vote, even if they're going to just go and vote for themselves.
Yeah, well, there may well be. That sounds like a good idea to me. To come back to this idea of Donald Trump, you know, Donald Trump can renege 100% on everything that he said during the past year in a media interview. I don't think I would believe that either. I think Trump is concerned, genuinely concerned about immigration. I think that he does see things quite clearly. I think he at this point just wants to get into office mm-hmm. and see what he can do and see what kind of support he can galvanize and what kind of movement he can generate. But until then, he's a politician. He's going to have to play the political game. Let's not beat around the bush here. The Jews aren't fooled. Mm-hmm. They know his intentions, and they will attack him with everything they've got. It's the same with the alt-right. Those in the alt-right can say, oh, you know, we don't mind the Jews, or we just, you know, they can frame it in whatever way they want to frame it. Jews know what it is. Mm-hmm. Heidi Beirich was on, I think it was MSNBC or a news channel recently. I just watched the interview earlier today where she basically said, look, the alt-right is anti-Semitic. It's vile. It's disgusting. You know, she really went on full attack mode.
Heidi Beirich, what was her name?
Yeah, Heidi Beirich, yeah, from the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And she went on, you know, full frontal attack, named Andrew Anglin and said, look, this movement is, you know, full-on anti-Semitic. So, you know, there are people in this game who are fully aware of the stakes and fully aware of where the battle lines are drawn. The Jews are very aware of where everyone stands. Those in the alt-right kind of maybe mixed in their perceptions as far as who the wire pullers are, but they're aware of the problems. The ethnic minorities in our societies are also very aware of where the battle lines are drawn because they're highly primed to see the world in racial terms. The only blindfolded participant in the great game is the white mass. And the great question of the age, if you want to put it like that, is how to take the blindfold off. Mm-hmm. And all of us are working unceasingly to take that blindfold off.
Okay.
And well, of course, our enemies are very, very keen to keep that on.
I know you. You're the famous Simon Templar.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Joyce.
It's been a pleasure again, Patrick.
This has been Patrick Slattery, and I'll be back again soon with another interesting guest on National Bugle Radio.